Going Linux, episode 205, Computer America, number 61. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Tom. Whether you're new to Linux, moving from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about upgrading to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in Going Linux.
We hope that you'll find this and all of our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done.
In today's episode, Computer America.
Computer America.
Hello and welcome into the Computer America show. It's the nation's longest running, nationally syndicated radio talk show on computers. Computer America is heard around the world and coast to coast, and I'm your host, Craig Crossman.
And I'm your co-host, Ben.
And it is the third Tuesday of the month. Boy, where is time going, right? And that means it's time for our All Linux show! Yes, it's all about Linux, the subject of Linux, and we're going to do that for both hours tonight. We dedicate the third Tuesday of every month to the subject of Linux. It's an extremely important operating system, we'll get to that, right now. As I mentioned, if you have a Linux question, tonight's the night for you to give us a call. Joining us in our Linux quest, if you will, is Linux expert Larry Bushy. Larry is the creator and host of the Going Linux podcast. Larry, welcome into Computer America. How are you tonight?
Linux Quest. I'm great. Linux Quest. It makes me feel like a knight or something, or a player in one of those
games. Yeah.
Online role playing games or something.
Well, Ben, Larry's out there single handedly proving that chivalry is not dead. At least, which might be a distribution of Linux. I don't know. There's a million of them.
Yes. You never know. You never know.
This is true. Well, we're going to, talk about Linux for the next 2 hours, and while we're doing that, you can step in and ask questions. This is the night that we dedicate to the subject of Linux for all the people who have questions about Linux, thinking about upgrading to Linux, or adding a different distribution of Linux, or anything having to do with that subject. We answer your questions now. The way that you get your questions answered is by contacting us directly when we're live and on the air. It is, and you can call us, 866-606-TALK, 866-606-8255. We'll get you on and get you through. Email, we have a special email inbox set up when we're live and on the air. It is live, L-I-V-E, at computeramerica.com. You can also join us in our live interactive add-on chat room. The way you do that is you go to our homepage at computeramerica.com, and you'll see toward the bottom half, there's a big blue button with white lettering on it. It says chat room. That's probably a good indicator that you need to push it if you want to go into the chat room. So select that or just click it. It'll ask you for a username. That's the name you'll be known by when you go in there. And click the sign in button and your Java-enabled browser, being on a Windows machine, Mac, Linux, they all work. It'll move you into the Computer America chat room where Larry is also participating. He has the green avatar signifying he is the guest for tonight. And you can see him in there and you can talk to him directly in the chat room, as are many people right now. And we certainly invite you to do that. You can also Skype us too if you like. Our Skype address is one word, Computer America, although we just encourage you to give us a call at 866-606-TALK. Okay, now... when Larry appears on the show, he's one of our correspondents. Larry provides us with a topic for the show. So it's going to be for the first hour, and then in the second hour, we'll have emails that Larry has received over the past month, and we'll read those and answer those questions as well. But if you have a question, so you can call us, email us, chat with us, or Skype us. So those are the methods to communicate with us. Now, as I said, we pick up a topic. I ask Larry to actually pick up a topic for us to discuss while we're waiting for your calls or whatever. And the topic for tonight is safe computing with Linux. I didn't know it was dangerous, but I guess it is. Safe computing with Linux. Now, here's the other thing that I want to mention to you. This is important. Most of our correspondence, and Larry is included with that, gives us what we not like. We've just kind of named it. What's known as a cheat sheet. And this is a document that we kind of read and use as we discuss the topics. We thought it would be nice if you could follow along with us. So we're making these documents available to you. All you have to do is go to our homepage at computeramerica.com, go to the Archives pull-down menu, and go click on the Show Notes option. It'll ask you to click here for the new show notes, so just click on that, and you'll see our show notes. And you'll see tonight's show, the 4/16/2013, and it talks about Larry and the show that's all Linux tonight. And below that, you will see the Linux topic of the month, and then you'll see all of the talking points and the links that we're going to be discussing on tonight's show there for you to click on. It's just right there. You can go for it. In the second hour, you go back to the show notes, and there's a hyperlink right toward the top of the current show notes that says emails. If you click on that, your browser will open a Google Docs document, and you can then follow along the emails that we're going to be reading in the second hour. So that's how you kind of participate and along with us here on tonight's show. And that's what we're going to be doing. So the topic is safe computing with Linux. And let's get started. What do you actually mean by safe computing with Linux, Larry?
Well, I guess it's a little bit redundant, isn't it? I mean, yeah. Linux is a safer operating system to use than other operating systems, partially because of the way it's designed and partially because it's it presents a smaller attack surface, if you will, for the bad guys that are trying to get at you and your computer and infect you with malware and viruses and all the other bad stuff on the internet. And as I said, that's partially due to the way that Linux is designed. But I wanted to talk about just general user safety, whether it's computing with Linux or any other operating system, and then some specific things around Linux as well. And, you know, Linux is minimally, I have to say, safer to use than OS X. There have been some infections in the wild for OS X. There have not been for Linux. I don't think overall either one is safer or less safe than the other. They're both based on the Unix operating system as the core of its design, and Unix is designed to be a safe operating system. It's designed to be a multi-user operating system. But it's much safer. Linux is much safer than using Windows. Originally, Windows wasn't designed as a multi-user operating system. It wasn't even designed to be used on the internet. And that's kind of an add-on later on. And as a result, in the early designs of Windows, safety on the internet, protection from viruses and spyware was kind of an afterthought. And there's a whole industry built up around protecting Windows from external threats, and yet OS X users and Linux users for years and years and years have been running without all that additional software on their computer to protect them. These days, it's getting to the point where even OS X users and Linux users might think about running antivirus software, anti malware software. But in general, Linux is safer as a general operating system. Having said all that, you still need to be careful no matter what operating system you're using, including Linux. And some of the things that cause me to say that you need to be careful are around the fact that human beings are, well, human. People fall for scams, and they fall for phishing scams and things like that. And, you know, one of the things you might want to think about is that your email probably hasn't won that $1 million in the Spanish lottery.
No.
Yeah, really, really. And you haven't received an unsolicited payment from PayPal.
Darn.
You know, yeah. And other bad news, Craig, your Microsoft network services aren't about to be deactivated, so you really don't have to go and verify your identity.
Boy.
Yeah. Here's the kicker. There's no exiled princess in the Philippines needing your help to smuggle out a metallic box of treasure.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So don't fall for social engineering or phishing scams or other kinds of scams like this. Computing is the delivery mechanism of these things, but it's really not a technology issue. It's a human issue, and people fall for this all the time, and it shows up in your email. You know, there's somebody there asking you to, you know, log in to your bank's email or your bank's.
Probably for the better.
How do you fall for a princess in the Philippines trying to smuggle out a metallic box of treasure? I mean, who falls for that?
Some people do.
Oh, my gosh. This is Computer America. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Twenty-one minutes after the hour here on the Computer America show, Ben and I are talking to Larry Bushy. He is the host of the Going Linux podcast. The topic for the show tonight, of course, is Linux, all Linux, and the subtopic really is safe computing with Linux. We're talking to Larry. Ben and I and Larry are hanging out in the Computer America chat room, and we have a couple of new users in there, but Ben is being antisocial. He's not even saying hello to the new people.
They're getting their warm welcome.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't realize we were the people who are at the front door of hotels. Like, welcome to our establishment. Please come in, take off your shoes.
Yes.
Take off your pants, even.
Welcome and relax in our chat room. Exactly.
It's relaxing, but that's just going a little too far.
Yes, it is, actually.
Okay, really? I'm going, okay, never mind. Okay, we're good.
So, anyway, we're talking about how you need to be careful, and there's no exiled princess in the Philippines.
You know why they're so obvious and painful, and you think, how could anyone fall for that?
Why is that?
Because the 1% of people that actually do send them their banking information, that send them their card, they're not going to realize halfway through, maybe this isn't the right, the right person, and maybe I'm being taken. They want people who will fall for it and follow through the entire way. So that's why that's why they put typos. That's why they put, absurd amounts of money. That's why they put, Nigerian prince. It's people who will fall for that in the first place will carry through with it. They do it on purpose.
That's an interesting way of thinking about it.
I can't imagine there are people that, and I have to be careful, but that.
Well, I mean,
gullible.
Think of how much it costs them. I mean, to get a spam list, just a bunch of random emails to send spam to, that can't be much money. And then having someone sit down and write an email, that costs no money. I mean, it for what they're doing, it's really cheap.
Yeah, but
you might as well.
But the fact that they hook somebody like that is just amazing. I just cannot believe it.
Yeah, and they come up with a new, must be enough money in it to keep them in business.
Evidently. Oh, they come up with a new twist, I'm stuck in South Korea and they stole my wallet and it would send me, $2,500 so I can get a
plane
ticket.
When I was looking for a roommate, I put a post up on Craigslist. And we would have people who would contact us, and it would be like a really short one answer. And then after that, they'd come back with a script, and they'd say, "Okay, I love to move in. They have a picture of a person. It's like, I love to move in, although I need to pay for the first month up front. So please send me your banking information so I can wire the first month's rent over,
and
then I'll be over there soon."
Soon.
At first glance, you're like, okay, that kind of makes sense, a pretty 23-year-old German girl who just finished her doctorate, just coming over to live in South Florida. I'm like, perfect. But after you talk with them a little bit, you realize, they're just reading from a script. They really can't, they really aren't who they say they are. So if you are taken for what you're worth, talk to them for a little bit, and you realize they aren't a real person.
Right.
You know, it's interesting because most all these that you're points that you're saying be careful in Linux really apply just to any platform.
To everyone.
Yeah.
Well, they do, and that's my point. Is that although the technology is safer with Linux, if you fall for one of these scams, you're giving away your information voluntarily. Mm-hmm. And there's no antivirus software. There's no well-built operating system with protection built in that can protect you from that kind of attack.
Social engineering.
You know,
attack.
If you click on attachments and emails that you receive from strangers, shame on you.
Yep, exactly.
You know,
heck, I don't even attach on links and emails from people I know. I just copy them and paste them into my browser, you know, window.
Right, right. And you know, if you weren't expecting an attachment or a link from somebody you know, contact them before you click on it and find out if they really sent it. Mm-hmm. I receive emails from people who have written into the Going Linux podcast by email. And every once in a while, I receive an email that has my name in the BCC field, the blind copy field.
Right.
And when I look at it, it is either some profane statement or some sort of advertising or some sort of, oh, click on this link, or, oh, I didn't, you won't believe the picture I saw of you, click here.
Mm.
That kind of stuff. And you know that someone has hacked into their email system or more than likely has just spoofed their email. They haven't even been hacked. They've gotten their email address somehow and they're making it look like this email is coming from them and they're just sending as many emails as they can to anybody that they have email addresses for.
Or maybe that person really is just angry at you and wants to get you in trouble.
Maybe so.
I don't think so.
Maybe I should be looking at this a little bit differently. Now, wait a minute. Well, and one of the things that you may not be aware of is that although Linux is designed so that in order to install software, you have to put in your password. You have to confirm that you realize that you are running software or at least running an installer, and the installer will pop up in front of you. You can run commands from a command line. Think of it, if for those Windows users who've been around a while, like a DOS prompt, you can enter in a command there, which will run a program, whether that program displays a screen or not, it will run. And if you're on a forum, which is a popular place for getting help with Linux issues, a lot of Linux distributions have forums that will help you out, and most of the people in there are nice, friendly, helpful people. But if you're on a forum or a blog or a web page that purports to be helping you with your Linux issues, even if you're desperately in need of something to fix your broken audio or video or wireless connection or whatever, don't just blindly copy and paste from the forum into the command line without knowing what it is you're doing.
Exactly.
Do a little bit of research first.
Yeah.
You know, they can give you anything and you can run it and suddenly your system is hosed or you've just downloaded an infection and installed it without really knowing it. Well, I guess if you didn't do your research and you weren't careful, you wouldn't even know it. And you may be thinking that somebody's trying to help you. So it's awful you have to think that way about folks. That's life these days on the internet.
Yes, it is. So what other points that we want to make here? Something about applying updates?
Yeah, sure. So some other ways that you can be safe using your Linux operating system. As with other operating systems, Linux provides updates, security updates, and they supply them on a regular basis. They provide them as soon as they're available. So apply them right away. as soon as you receive them. And most Linux distributions have software updater that will tell you when there are updates waiting to be installed. And they'll just send them to you automatically. Depending on your Linux distribution, you can control what level of updates you get, whether you get just the security updates or whether you get updates plus upgrades to software packages. And this is not just the operating system itself. This is any software application that you have installed from the repository that came with your Linux distribution. The updates apply to all of that.
All right. Good tip. Now, when we come back, let's talk some more about these, including like using a router. Even if you don't need one, you should use it anyway. We'll talk about that. This is Computer America.
Welcome back to the Computer America Show. Larry Bushy joins us for our Linux show, and we're just going over some of the ways to save a computer on Linux.
Yes.
And one of them is to apply updates as soon as possible. And that is pretty contradictory to what most Windows users are used to, because until it's been out in the wild for a week or two, or been available to the public and all the bugs are worked out, there's really no, like, unless it's like a Windows update or an anti, one of your malware protection services, you really don't want to update it because things can break, especially things like drivers and programs. Things can break, but I guess it doesn't happen as often in Linux.
I don't think it's a matter of how frequently things are changed, especially around security updates. The difference is that with Linux, they develop the security patches and they send them out as soon as the issue is identified and resolved and tested out. And with Windows, let's see, you have to wait for Patch Tuesday. Who knows how long it's taken them to develop the patch? And then they send it out, and then you're thinking, well, maybe I shouldn't apply it until people have had it for a while just to make sure it's not going to break anything. So by the time you actually get around to patching it, how long has that infection possibly been banging away on your computer? I don't know. So, there are security issues with everything, and many of the security issues these days are with the browser. And if you're using something like Firefox or Chrome, you're using the same browser potentially that you could be using on Windows or Mac. And the problem is the browser itself may have some issues that the bad guys are exploiting. Or maybe one of the plugins. It may be a PDF reader plugin that allows you to look at PDFs in your browser, or something that allows you to play audio files or videos, Flash, notorious for having security holes in it. And those plugins are very similar, if not identical, for the browser on any platform. And so if there's a security hole in Flash, for example, for Firefox on Windows, it's very, very likely that exact same security hole appears on Linux as well. In that Firefox browser. Now, typically, those infections that you get will either infect the browser and make it so that you can't help but click on or somehow be sent to a website that may try to infect your computer. Mm-hmm. And typically, they're going to be looking to infect a Windows computer, even if you're running from a Linux machine. And so if you're running Linux or if you're running the Mac and you're using a browser and you're exploited in this way, it's not going to have any effect. You won't see the infection because it can't infect you. It's not Windows. So it's not that you're any safer from attack. It's that you're safer from infection because you're not their target. Now, what if they were? What if they were targeting your Linux machine? That happened to Mac users not that long ago, and it could very easily happen to a Linux user as well. Now, if somebody sends you to a website and gets you to go there where they will automatically start a download of something and try to start installing it, Linux is going to intervene. And it's going to say, okay, well, you're trying to install something, put in your password. Well, you know, the average Linux user, Linux gets a bad rap for being for techies. Well, the other side of that is most of the time, most of the users of Linux are techies because it's the users of Linux that develop Linux and program for Linux. So the Linux audience tends to be a little more technically savvy. And so when they see their password prompt pop up, they're going to think, wait a minute, I didn't do anything that's going to require a password. What's going on here? So they'll be a little more suspicious.
Red flag.
Than your average user who will click on anything, anywhere, anytime. So, but if you do put in your password and you get infected, it's your own fault. But typically, because Linux is a much smaller target than Windows, the risk of that is very, very low. Not to say it's nothing, because there is a risk. And one day, Linux is going to be a target as well. So that's why we're talking about safe computing on Linux.
So tell us about using a router.
So I suggest using a router even if you don't need one. And the reason for that is a router stands between you and the internet. And it's just a dumb box that sits there, and you tell it, I want to go to this website, and it gives you the website. It goes to the website and passes it through the router software and sends it to you. And if there's any sort of traffic trying to get into your computer that you didn't request, it's just going to say, I don't know what to do with this, and it just ignores it.
I never knew my router could speak.
yeah, it can, and that's exactly how it talks.
I know. Okay. All right.
Okay. So anyway, it is a dumb box, and it doesn't know from new stuff coming in that you didn't request, so it just forgets about it.
Wait a minute. Now, some routers are not that dumb. I mean, some routers are fairly smart.
Well, absolutely. And if you do have a router, make sure that it's got the latest firmware, because it's a computer these days, you know. And if you have, there are security updates for routers. And if you can update the software on your router to the latest version, you're applying the security patch, and you're going to prevent your router from becoming the infected computer in your network or just outside your network.
I always take a deep breath though when I get a router update or a notification. I always a little hesitant because you know the old song, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And sometimes I'll update a firmware patch to a router, and then nothing works. And then what do you do?
A lot of Windows users use that same if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So I really don't need to apply the patches and see where that gets them.
That's true.
So, it is a little scary when you've got a box that you can't do anything with except address through a browser, and you're trying to do a software update. It's kind of the same feeling you get if you've ever tried to root your mobile phone or jailbreak your mobile phone. Yeah. It's like, am I sure I want to do this?
Yeah, exactly.
It's that kind of feeling. Yeah. And I understand it, but you keep abreast of those software updates. It'll save your computer's life one day.
Okay.
So, and the router itself acts as a firewall, a hardware firewall. It's a barrier between you and the internet. And whether you have a router or not, you might want to consider installing a software firewall. And if you're using Linux, the likelihood is there that there's already one installed, and it may need to be turned on. You may need to go into the firewall and just set it to on, and it will start blocking traffic. Mm-hmm. And if you do that and the internet stops working, then you have to go in and actually make some configuration changes to tell it what you want to pass through. These firewalls these days, even on Linux, tend to be fairly user-friendly. Firewalls in general are meant for tech-savvy people, but there are firewalls with names like Uncomplicated Firewall that come pre-installed on Linux, and you just switch them on, and they tend to work for most things. But if you're doing anything sophisticated with your computer, like gaming on the internet, and you need to ensure that you can connect to the gaming server, then you'll need to provide a path through that firewall. And you're probably going to be a little more technically savvy, or at least the game producer is going to provide you with some suggestions as to how to make that work. But the firewall, the software firewall, will help you, as does the hardware firewall. But you actually have a little more setup to do with that than you do a router. I like a router because you just plug it in and it works, and it knows what to send through and what not to send through. And a software firewall takes a little bit more, so you really do need to learn how to use it. And the only time it's working is when it's turned on, so remember to check that it's on, even though it may be installed.
And you should do a hardware firewall. It's going to be more effective than a software firewall if you're going to do that.
Generally speaking, yep.
Yes, good. All right, Ben, were you going to say something?
Yeah, no, it's got to wait till after the break.
Okay, well, when we come back, Ben's going to say something.
I do these kind of stuff here, folks.
This is
easy.
This is
I promise I won't say anything.
This is the Computer America Show. It's our all Linux show tonight. Larry Bushy continues on with us. We'll be right back. Larry Bushy continues on with us, and we're talking about safe computing with Linux in this remainder of the hour, and then we're going to go over to emails. And again, if you have any questions or comments about Linux, you know how to reach us, 866-606-TALK, the toll-free number, live at computeramerica.com, or email address, or of course, the chat room at computeramerica.com. So let's kind of finish up. We talked about firewall and routers. A couple more quick points. Don't leave remote control software set for auto-connect and running 24/7. Why not?
Well, yeah, a lot of people like to leave TeamViewer or VNC or even on a Mac or a Linux machine running SSH so that you can log in remotely. And unless you have a password on there and have it really secured, certainly don't leave it so that it logs you in automatically when you connect. That's just inviting somebody to take control of your computer and do things with it you never knew people could do.
Yeah, but what if you need to get access to your control, remotely? I mean, let's log me in.
Well, you can set up TeamViewer, for example, to auto answer and to auto
authenticate.
Auto authenticate, and so you can go to work, you can log in from your work computer to your home computer, and you can navigate around. Which seems very convenient, but very, very insecure. Just be careful with that kind of stuff. That's not good. Another thing you could do, if you have a grandmother or a grandfather that is a little computer shy or finds difficulty seeing and navigating with a mouse and a keyboard, buy them a Telekin.
A Pelican?
No, not a Pelican. No, this is a Telekin.
Oh, okay.
A Telekin is a touch screen computer. Yeah. It's actually hardware from MSI. I think they're a Korean computer manufacturer with a touch screen and a very large type on the keyboard itself so that people with vision problems can see the keyboard. But you don't need the keyboard because it's got a touch screen.
Very nice.
And it's got a nice menu down the left-hand side. It's got Skype built in. It's got all kinds of weather applications, photo sharing, all that. And it runs on Linux.
Very nice.
And they provide services for seniors, and certainly not just for seniors, but they have an 18-inch and a 20-inch LCD touchscreen. Yeah. Really cool. Yeah. I kind of stumbled across it, and I thought it was pretty darn nice.
Okay.
But
in the worst case, you know, but if she's not up for it, then just buy her a Pelican from Korea, and she'll be happy.
There you go.
I've heard many, many horror stories about people finally getting their grandparents on Facebook, and then, of course, for the next, you know, forever, they get, you know, casserole recipes sent to their Facebook, and they get, you know, just cute cat pictures sent to their Facebook all the time, and grandma posting on your wall all the time. I mean, I could not imagine giving my grandparents access to my Skype account as well.
Well, don't give them a Facebook account and a scanner, or you'll find your baby pictures on Facebook. Not a good combination.
And Photoshop. Photoshopped as well, exactly.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So last point, I think, is don't run Windows natively. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is back up your Windows on your computer if it came pre-installed. Install Linux. And then install Windows in a virtual machine. You'll be much safer. It'll be behind its own virtual machine firewall so that even if it gets infected, you can reinstall or just make a backup copy of that virtual machine of Windows. And then when it gets infected, not if, but when, just restore it from a backup. Much faster to restore and a much safer way to use Windows.
Okay.
If you have to.
All right, so there you go. Safe computing with Linux, we're up against the top of the hour break. So when we come back, we're going to do emails. These are collections of emails that are sent to us or to Larry over the month, and then we're going to read them to you. In the meantime, we're going to break for your local and national news. I'm going to play with my Korean pelican over here, and then we'll continue on with hour two. Quiet. This is the Computer America Show. Here, have some birdseed. We'll be right back. Stay with me.
Computer America. Computers run the world, and we run computers. Call us toll-free, 866-606-TALK. That's 866-606-TALK. Or send us an email to live@computeramerica.com.
Hello, and welcome into hour two of the nation's longest-running, nationally syndicated radio talk show on computers. This is the Computer America Show, and I'm your host, Craig Crossman.
And I'm your co-host, Ben.
And we continue on. It's the third Tuesday of the month, and it is our All Linux Show with Larry Bushy, our Computer America Linux correspondent. He is the creator and host of the Going Linux podcast. And again, we'll keep lines open. If you have a question about Linux, give us a call, 866-606-TALK. Email live@computeramerica.com or chatroom@computeramerica.com. So, Larry, we're going to continue on with this. And again, if you're just joining us, don't forget that you can see what we're seeing. Just head over to computeramerica.com and click on under the archives menu our show notes button, and then you'll see all the everything we're talking about here tonight, our cheat notes and the emails as well in a Google Docs document. So we're going to start off with Gregory, who has a discovery for you, and let's read that.
Okay. Gregory writes, hi, Larry, Tom, and Bill. I just discovered something that could possibly save someone's days of debugging. I wrote a blog post about how to get Ubuntu and UEFI to work on my new-ish Asus motherboard. Apparently, UEFI never worked properly when this motherboard was first released, but they have recently released a new BIOS version that seemed to fix all of my troubles.
What is UEFI?
UEFI is a technology that's been built into motherboards for a while that provides an alternative to BIOS booting. And recently, Microsoft has provided a little add-on to UEFI called Secure Boot. And what that is meant to do is to prevent your computer on booting from running a rootkit or from it's to reduce the risk of being infected by something that works at a hardware level or a machine level. So, Microsoft has provided some tweaking to UEFI to make it Microsoft-ish. And one of the things that they require of computer manufacturers is that if they want to display made for Windows 8 on their hardware, they must use Secure Boot and UEFI. One of the downsides to that is if you are running UEFI and Secure Boot and you try to install anything other than Windows 8, including older versions of Windows on that computer, it won't let you. And of course, that's a problem for Linux. And so the Linux folks have been trying to devise a way around this. And companies like Canonical that make Ubuntu software and the folks over at OpenSUSE and Red Hat have all, in one way or another, either developed a bootloader that gets around the secure boot or have purchased a license from Microsoft that allows them to boot Linux on a computer, even though they remove Windows from the computer, they still have to purchase this this license from Microsoft because it's a certified Windows 8 computer. So, you know, the Linux community was all up in arms that this was Microsoft trying to prevent Linux from being installed on PC hardware, and I don't know whether there's much truth to that, but bottom line is companies like Ubuntu and Red Hat and so on have found a way to make this work. And some computers that you purchase off the shelf today with Windows 8 installed on them will provide you with a way of turning off UEFI so that it goes back to BIOS booting and then everything works just fine. But you purchase a computer from Dell or HP and you ask them, is this using UEFI or is this using Secure Boot? And most of the time they say, we don't know. And typically it's not on their specs. And so you have to purchase the computer and then try to install Linux on it to see if it will even install. And then I suppose if they have a generous return policy, if it's got UEFI and you can't make it work, you can return it. But that seems like an awfully expensive way to go.
It's like a fortune cookie, but instead of a fortune, it's license crippling software.
Yeah, or it's like some I don't want to lay any blame here, but it's kind of like some countries' governments' healthcare bills that they say you have to pass it before you know what's in it, not to mention any names. Yeah, that kind of stuff. So anyway, getting back to Gregory's email here, he purchased this computer, this Asus motherboard with UEFI on it that didn't quite work well until he got an update. And so this update finally, as he says, they released released a new BIOS version that seemed to fix his troubles. And he's written a blog post on it. We'll include the blog link to his blog post in the show notes. It's very specific to a very particular model of Asus motherboard. If anybody has this P8 P67 motherboard from Asus and is having problems with this UEFI thing, maybe the update will fix that problem for you as well. And typically what you do is there's some key combination that lets you get to the UEFI. It's not really a bootloader. Maybe it is a bootloader. But it gets you into the UEFI, and then there will be a selection to let you turn it off, which puts it back into BIOS mode. They may call it turn off UEFI, or it may say use unsecure booting or something that makes it sound really scary to do.
But it's just turning on the BIOS back. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, turn it back to what it used to be for decades before UEFI was ever invented. And just use it as normal. So, Microsoft puts a barrier for Linux one way or another.
I actually have UEFI on my computer, and I actually like it.
Yeah, you know, if it doesn't have Secure Boot on it, no problem at all for Linux users. You may have to tweak something here that you might not have to do with a standard BIOS, but for general purpose use, it seems to be just fine. And, you know, Mac computers use a similar sort of thing. And, you know, you can install Linux on there just fine. It's just this secure boot thing that, that Windows has insisted going on. And they have allowed it to be disabled if the processor on the computer is an Intel processor or an AMD processor. But if it's the kind of processor that is used on a tablet machine, then they have written into their specs that you must not allow disabling of secure boot on those processors. And those are the kind of processors that were on the netbooks when they first came out.
Yeah. Ben, what do you like? What do you like about UEFI? You have it on your computer on your Origin PC?
Yeah.
Yeah, what do you like about it?
It just has, you know, big easy buttons, and it shows your temperature and all your RAM speed and your core speed and your processor speed. You know, you can go power saving, you can go extreme, you know, performance, you can go balance. It's just kind of like a GUI for your BIOS.
Yeah, it sounds less cryptic. In other words, and yeah, it has a graphical user interface rather than BIOS just text.
I think it's okay, but it sounds like the secure boot is the problem. And in my computer, I know my computer doesn't have that. And it sounds like one of those things where it's like, you know, Windows is like, you know, no one's really going to care. You know, there's not really going to be an uproar. Yeah. And then when you're in our line of work, you hear people say, secure boot is the worst thing that has ever happened. And now I can't even install my old copy of Windows 7. This is Windows 7 or even Linux. It's awful.
And if you want to use Windows 8 and you never want to switch from that, it's no problem at all. You'll never even know it's there. It's not a problem as long as you continue to use the latest weird GUI interface from Microsoft.
Okay.
That's my editorializing there.
There you go. Well, that said, we're up against our first break, and we are in our All Linux show with Larry Bushy reading emails. This next one that's coming up is going to be from one of our regular members in the Computer America chat room, KY Engineer. We'll read that when we come back. This is the Computer America Show. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Computer America Show. Ben and I are talking to Larry Bushy. We're doing emails in the second hour that are written to him over the past month. Some of them are from our show, and this one falls into that category, all questions about Linux, because this is our All Linux show. It's the third Tuesday of the month. And this next email is from one of our chat room participants. His name's KY Engineer, and he wrote an email to you, Larry. So why don't you read this?
Yeah, so KY Engineer wrote, "Hello, Larry, Tom, and Bill." Before I start this, I have to say, my scientific method for choosing emails for the show kind of failed me last month. My scientific method is I start at the top of the email box and work my way down. And this one came in just after our show, or at least I read it just after the show last month. So it's been a month, and after I read this, we'll find out what the results were for KY Engineer's issue here. So he wrote, "I have been listening to your show for a while, and I have become a Linux fan. I want to host a web server from my home. This is a hobby project. I'm running an Apache web server on Ubuntu Server operating system in VirtualBox on my PC. I want to make my website available on the internet. Okay. The computer sits on my home network that is connected to the internet by ATTUverse. I have found the broadband IPv4 address. It's 107.210. And, of course, he puts XXXXXS because he does not want his internet IP address on the internet, or on the radio for that matter. He continues, "The problem is I can't see the website from the internet. I've set up port forwarding in my router. I think the problem is the VirtualBox setup. Can you or someone in the chat room point me in the right direction? I believe one of the chat room regulars knows about virtual machines. Thanks, KY Engineer." And KY Engineer is in the chat room right now, as is the person who provided him with the answer, and that is iNetKen. And I have slipped into the show notes the response from iNetKent in the Going Linux chat room, which I pointed KY Engineer to. And it looks like, and KY, correct me in the chat room if this isn't correct, but it looks like it was a setting on the VirtualBox setup. And essentially what you need to do is you need to tell VirtualBox not to act essentially as a little firewall between your host computer and the virtual computer, but rather to use the network adapter and pass through all the traffic as though there were no as though your virtual box were sitting right there on your hardware computer's network connection. So that pass through setting, I believe, is what has happened and has fixed the problem for KY Engineer. At the very least, he says that he's now able to see his website from the internet.
There you go.
I don't see any reply on the chat yet. So I'm gonna say my answer is correct.
Okay.
That's what I do when in doubt.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm right. I must be right.
Nobody's told me I'm wrong, so I must be right.
All right. Well, then let's move on then to the next email from someone called Gus, and he has a question. According to him, he has a question that raises a valid issue that people don't always talk about.
Mm. Yes. Oh my goodness! This is one of those hidden, dark, deep secrets of Linux.
Okay.
Yeah. Gus writes, "Hello, Tom, Larry, and Bill. I may have gotten those in different order, but that's okay. No one will know. I have been using Linux exclusively for a while now, and it just dawned on me that some media codecs might not be legal for me to use. I don't use libdvd-css or anything to rip copy-protected DVDs or anything like that. I don't need Adobe Flash or Oracle Java because I use GNASH and OpenJDK, the open-source versions of those. Mm-hmm. Do you know if codecs like libmp3lame and libx264, or if using VLC is legal?
Ooh.
I have a legal copy of Windows, so does that mean I have a legal access to media codecs? Gus." Mm-hmm. Well, Gus, this is one of those issues that is in a
gray area.
Yeah. So we've got a bunch of links in the show notes to a bunch of stuff that you might want to take a look at. So first of all, there's a the issue is framed in a relatively old post from Purdue University. We've got that as our first link. It's entitled "The Illegal Playback Issue." And essentially what they talk about in there is something that relates to the MP3 codec. And a codec is something that's a coding and encoding and decoding software that allows you to encode or record an MP3 file and decode it so that you can play it back. It also applies to H.264, which is a very popular video format. And each of those is encumbered by licensing, some very restrictive licensing that for people residing in Canada and in the United States brings into question whether it's even legal to play an MP3 or an H.264 video without a license. Did you know you had to have a license to play an MP3?
No.
Apparently you do. And so this article from Purdue University frames it out. It's relatively old, so they mention some things that have actually been dispelled, but they mention some other things around the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And some things around DVDs as well related to DVD players. And they mention an old defunct Linux distribution called Linspire. So Linspire was some version of Linux that you had to pay $49 for at the time, and apparently it was supposed to have included the license for playing all of these things. But one of the things that all of this licensing hullabaloo can be resolved with is the fact that if you are concerned that because Linux is open source and because Linux is free as in freedom, and that really means that most Linux distributions that are truly free versions or GNU Linux versions are going to provide you their Linux distribution without the ability to record MP3 files or playback DVDs or even play MPEG 2 or MPEG 4 or DivX or even AAC audio. There is a way to acquire a license. They're going to provide it without that ability, and we'll talk about that after the break.
Okay. This is the Computer America Show on the Business Talk Radio Network. We're doing emails that Larry Bushy, co-host of the Going Linux podcast, gets over the month. We'll be right back after these words. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome back to the Computer America Show. We are doing emails from Larry Bushy and those he gets throughout the month, and I believe we're still talking about the codecs that come with most computers, and we weren't finished with that one, right?
Right.
That's right. So we were talking about Gus and his question about can I play a DVD legally on Linux?
No, they'll knock on your door.
The answer is. Maybe.
I love that.
It's just weird that the whole question came up. I mean, most people assume, okay, well, I have Linux, and it runs DVDs. I can watch whatever DVD I have, and right. That's as far as most people's thought goes.
Right.
Right. But if you install Debian Linux or even Ubuntu Linux. It's going to be provided without the ability to play a commercial DVD, without the ability to record in MP3 format, without the ability to play a H.264 video, because each of those has licensing requirements around it that in the United States and Canada, unless you have software that includes the license to play those or encode the MP3, or unless you have purchased a license, there's an argument that can be made that you are breaking the law if you do so. So they distribute the Linux operating system without those codecs. Now, first of all, IANL. I mean, I am not a lawyer, IANL, okay? I don't know how you pronounce that, but it looks like IANL to me. Anyway, I'm not a lawyer, and so anything that I say, don't take it as legal advice, okay? But my understanding is that it's not illegal for you to encode an MP3 or to play a DVD or to play an H.264 video. It's illegal for someone to provide you with the software to do that in the United States. And so they don't. They provide you with Linux without that ability, and then they provide you a handy little link so that you can go and get the software yourself. And they provide a nice easy way to install it. So it's kind of a workaround, but it is an inconvenience. Now, if you are still unconvinced and you still want to make absolutely sure that you're wearing both belt and suspenders, and you want to find a way to pay for these codecs, there is a website that you can go to, www.fluendo.com. And the folks behind Fluendo, who are located over in Europe somewhere, provide you with a nice packaged set of licenses that you can purchase for 28 euros, which is just under $40, that gives you MPEG 2 and H.264 and MPEG 4 and MP3 and WMA and all the license encumbered. Codecs to be able to play them and record and everything you need.
And not worry about people knocking on your door, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you're afraid that you're going to become the mother of a teenager who downloaded one song and becomes sued by the recording industry because they have lost millions and millions of dollars of revenue because, somebody downloaded a song, then you go to Fluendo and you pay for this. Or you just go yourself and you download, if you've installed Ubuntu Linux, you just use their software updater to go and get this, all these plugins and all the codecs and everything you need, and you're off and running. Or you install something like Linux Mint that comes with everything pre-installed. Yep. Well, you might be saying, well, okay, so why does Ubuntu not provide it and Linux Mint does? Well, Linux Mint is actually derived from Ubuntu. They start with Ubuntu and then they add on a bunch of stuff and then they add on all these codecs and so on. The thing is, Ubuntu is playing it safe. They are a UK company and they're playing a little bit safe there by not providing it. They're not tempting the law. Linux Mint is also from over on that side of the pond. They're actually in Ireland, and these things are not illegal in Ireland. There is no DMCA that they have to abide by over there, so they can legally provide it, and so they do. And so you can install Linux and then go and install these things afterwards, or you can just go and get Linux Mint and have it all pre-installed for you and not worry about it. The end result is exactly the same. You have the same ability. There's no advantage or disadvantage to either other than the whole avoiding the legal issue or potential legal issue, which to my knowledge has never really been tested in court anyway. And, with Linux Mint, just to play it safe for those people who want to play it safe but still want to use Linux Mint on a computer from the United States and don't want to risk anything at all,
Fluendo,
they have a download of a version without all this stuff installed, specially designed for those folks in North America who are paranoid, who want to play it safe, and they can go and do the Ubuntu thing and download it separately if they wish.
I like that word Fluendo. It rolls trippingly off the tongue.
It does. It does. The one thing that they don't provide, though, is the ability to play commercial DVDs. If you go back to that article from Purdue University, they highlight the whole DVD thing quite clearly. The author of this article decided that he wanted to go and actually purchase a license so that he could legally play his DVDs on his Linux machine.
Yeah.
Well, he found out who the licensing authority is. He went to them and they said, we don't provide a license for individual users. You have to use software that already has that license purchased by a big mega corporation. Mm-hmm. By the way, we don't provide any of that software for Linux, so you're just going to have to use another operating system, I guess.
Great.
So, yeah. So that's where folks like the infamous DVD John have developed the, quote, cracking software that actually provided the source code for actually being able to play commercial DVDs. You know, he uncracked the uncrackable code, or he cracked the uncrackable code around DVD security, and since then
he gained a lot of notoriety for that.
He gained a lot of notoriety for that and has gone on to other things now. Yeah. But since then, Linux has had the ability to pre-install the software to go ahead and play DVDs. And, of course, nobody would be ripping DVDs or that they shouldn't be ripping anyway commercial DVDs without actually purchasing the DVD anyway. Mm-hmm. So we shouldn't need to worry about that, right?
Okay. All right.
There you go.
All right. Well, then let's move on to Ivor. He had some concerns over some of your comments, Larry. You have to be careful what you say.
I know. That's why I'm being very careful about what I'm saying about these legal issues.
Yes. We heard the tap dancing going on.
Yeah. You heard that, huh? I'm wearing my tap shoes. So Ivor wrote, I was a bit concerned about the information you gave in Computer America episode number 60. That's the Going Linux episode number for the Computer America rebroadcast episodes. You made Linux out to run everything Macintosh does. That printers and such work just fine with Linux. I'd rather be honest and say Linux supports a small subset of what's available on Windows and the Macintosh. That small subset is usually enough for casual users. Ivor.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Ivor.
Okay.
There's a saying, something about mountains and molehills, and there are printers that don't work with Linux, just as there are printers that don't work with Mac, just as there are printers that don't work with Windows. Not everything works with any operating system, and Linux is no exception. Moving on.
It's getting better, though. Yeah. less and less incompatibility.
Yeah, Linux sucks. It sucks less.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Wait, what is okay. That's the tap shoes.
What's I hear? What do I hear? Okay. All right. Sorry. Go ahead.
Moving on. Richard asks about the ribbon for LibreOffice.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Richard says, "Hi guys. On a recent episode, you mentioned a ribbon interface being available for LibreOffice, but I'm not finding it anywhere, including your show notes, Google, and other search engine results. Am I missing something? Where is it available? Thanks. Answers to that questions and more after the break."
Okay.
Questions such as, someone actually likes the ribbon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You like the ribbon, Ben. You're a ribbon fan.
I do.
Yes,
but
you do.
But I wouldn't go out of my way to install it.
All right, well, we'll come back and we'll see if we can help out Richard find the ribbon of his dreams. Welcome back to the Computer America Show. We're talking to Larry Bushy, and we're doing emails. And just before the break, we were doing Ivor had expressed some concerns. Richard was talking about the ribbon interface and that the fact that he couldn't find it for LibreOffice. He wants to know if he's missing something. Where is it available? You know, where can he get it? And we read his email, and now you're going to tell him.
Right. So I actually mentioned this on last month's Computer America, the live radio show here. And I have to say, I was wrong. It's not available for LibreOffice. It turns out that what I was thinking about was actually a preview of a new interface for OpenOffice that they actually never came out with. However, there are plenty of plugins and add-ons for both LibreOffice and OpenOffice. We'll have a link to their site where you can get those add-ins. And the one thing you won't be able to find is the ribbon interface, unfortunately. So if you really, really like the ribbon interface, I'm afraid you're going to have to use Microsoft Office. And that means you'll have to use Windows or at least go online to Office 365 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't tried it. Maybe it'll work from Linux, but you have to really want that ribbon to do that, in my opinion.
Yeah, exactly.
And some people do. Some people like it.
Ben likes it.
Yeah.
It's growing.
Well, it takes a little getting used to. I have to use it at work, and I'm still getting used to it. it's one of those things when you're using an office suite, you end up memorizing your where the keyboard shortcuts are, and you remember what they are, and it's different on the ribbon. So
okay.
There you go.
All right, let's go. I think we have time. Yeah, we could go. We can do
one more.
Jim, he wants to install Linux from a USB device.
Okay, so Jim says, "Hi all. Could you explain again how to install a Linux distribution on a USB device? And or at least point me to a current tutorial on the subject. I want to be able to run the distro as if it is installed to the hard drive and save the work to the USB device. I'm currently using Linux Mint 14 on both a Veriten PC and a Toshiba notebook. I'm back in Mexico, so I depend on Skype for my phone again. It is working so well that it is almost like using a landline. Which leads me to a hardware tip I've discovered recently. The Veriten does not handle Wi-Fi very well. I went through a lot of distro hopping, trying to find something that worked. Even Linux Mint didn't handle Wi-Fi well. I was at Best Buy looking at buying a more powerful router to see if that would help when I noticed a product called a Wi-Fi extender. I tried it, and it solved my internet problems with the Veriten. I am able to connect to the extender with an Ethernet cable, thus bypassing Wi-Fi altogether. I figure it is a hardware problem with the Veriten, as the notebook on Wi-Fi is still faster than the Veriten in download speeds. Now Skype works very well on both computers. A nephew installed one in his house, and it improved the reception so well that his daughter no longer complains about the poor reception in her room. Enjoy the show and appreciate your efforts to make using Linux easier and more enjoyable. Thanks, Jim. Well, back to the top of his email, where he's trying to find a way to run Linux from a USB device in a way that allows him to run it as though it were installed on his on a hard drive. And there is a way to do that. And you can use this method on from a Linux computer or a Mac computer or a Windows computer to create a USB device that puts the Linux software on that USB thumb drive or whatever it is in a way that is called persistent. So the software you'll need is something called UNET Bootin. It's UNETBOOTIN. And you can go to unetbootin.com, get that software. And what this little utility does is it does one thing, and it does it well. It takes a live CD image of Linux and puts it on a USB device, like a thumb drive or a SD card or anything that is a bootable device from your computer. And there's a setting there when you record it that allows you to set it up as persistent. And what persistent means is it will be installed. Let's say it's a thumb drive you're installing to. So it'll install as though it were a USB, a live USB disk or a live DVD or whatever you want to call it that allows you to boot from it. But unlike booting from a DVD or a standard live USB, which only allows you to run it and then any settings you change or any software you install is gone the next time you boot, with the persistent setting, it actually saves your settings and any software that you've installed or anything you've uninstalled back to the USB and runs it as though it were on the just like it would be on a hard drive.
All right, Larry. Well, listen, we're out of time, and I'm glad we were able to get those emails in. And thank you so much for being with us here tonight. And I guess we're going to catch you next month again, same time, same station. Okay.
Be here,
Larry. Thanks so much for being with us here tonight. Really do appreciate it. All right.
New music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.